This is episode 14 of Parallel Lines.
Episode 14 of Parallel Lines, and we're standing at the entrance to this great big building that's full of some amazing history, in fact. Do we call it the oldest locomotive?
I think we do. We call it the oldest,
working passenger locomotive.
Yeah. And so it normally lives at the National Railway Museum, but we are actually in Litchurch Lane Depot in Derby, which, given how much I prattle on about my railway heritage, my dad in Heaton Depot, it's nice for us to be in an actual railway depot.
And this is the beginning of the greatest gathering, which we plugged weeks ago, and it's now finally happening. This is the big railway exhibition to celebrate Rail 200. Let's just walk over to that loco, because we have here Locomotion.
And when you say the greatest gathering, it is great, isn't it? It's massive.
It is huge. So Locomotion here, this first loco that pulled passengers, and it's wooden.
There is a lot of metal, but it's, yeah, a lot of it's wood.
And it's got things that stick up on the top that go up and down because it had vertical cylinders. So it looks quite
Wallace and Gromit, doesn't it? An invention out of Wallace and Gromit. And it's also tiny compared to what we would think of a locomotive nowadays. It's a great big thing, isn't it? This is, I'd say, maybe at least half the size, maybe a third of the size of a modern locomotive.
Indeed. And people, when they bought tickets for inside or outside seating in those days.
What would you have preferred, Tony?
Well, I would have preferred the inside, but they were in open wagons, half the passengers at least. So, I mean, that is how it's changed.
There's one of the original, presumably.
I think that's where the coal went.
That's the coal wagon. So there must have been a bloke stood on that bit.
And they stood up. The discussion of whether drivers should sit or stand, which goes on around the world, the first drivers stood. But looking at it, it's a huge feat of engineering, because it was able to pull passengers and it did the first passenger service. But looking at it now, you can't imagine that. I mean, it's got no speedo, that's one of the things. So they didn't know how fast they were going. So how do you keep to a timetable when you didn't even know how fast you're going anyway? But such a fantastic thing, and from that has grown. We're looking at further down the building now at a modern commuter train. It's an adventure there.
It's nice how they've got them next to each other, isn't it? Locomotive one right next to the Aventra, which is the most recent thing to be built here in Litchurch Lane. They design, they build, and they maintain trains here, which is pretty unique. In fact, we were told it's entirely unique.
Certainly for the UK, this is the only place where they can build a train and then check it works before they send it out. Otherwise, you tow it somewhere to test it. So it's a huge celebration. We're at the press launch, or the dignitaries launch, or the something launch. I don't quite know. It's the launch, anyway, of the event.
It's the first event I've ever been to on the railway where they've had to say welcome to an excellence.
Yes, the French ambassador is here. This is how important it is. So, and you're here for the first time with a badge on that says press.
Indeed, my first ever press badge. And, you know, given that I used to be a member of the press pack when I was a child. Do you remember that? The BBC used to have a thing.
Oh, were you part of it?
I think you paid a fee, Tony, and you were allowed in. It wasn't like a Blue Peter badge. You didn't have to earn it.
So you got the membership book and all that kind of thing.
And I used to quite fancy myself as a little journalist.
So, well, it's only taken you how many years?
But yes, it's taken me a bit longer than I planned. But little Anna Jane is quite pleased with herself for finally making it into the press pack.
And Anna Jane knows a lot of people. And I know a few people. So we are going to wander around now, because there's quite a few people here that have also come to celebrate this event, the beginning of the big three-day event. There'll be 10,000 people a day coming here over the next 3 days. I'm going to pop back on Saturday, but you've got other things to do. But we're going to go and see who's here and see what they think of what they're seeing and the Rail 200 celebration.
Yeah, and we'll probably describe a few other little bits and pieces that are here for people who can't get to it, because it was very limited in terms of 10,000 sounds a lot, but, you know, there's a lot of people interested in the railway. So the tickets were gone. It was like Glastonbury. They were gone on a waiting list and all the rest of it. So we will have a little wander around and have a look at stuff for you as well.
So, Rob White, what are you in Alston?
So I'm the Managing Director of the UK and Ireland.
And so presumably you had to say, yes, this can happen.
Yeah, I have to admit, when it was first presented to me, it was slightly smaller scale. I think we were 30 to 50 trains and a maximum of 5,000 people. But now we're 140 trains and we're expecting 40,000 people. I mean, just seeing what the site has transformed in the last week, let's not forget we design, build, test trains here. Turning it into a visitor attraction is not really one of the things we do very often. In fact, I think the last time we opened the doors to the public, I wasn't born, so we're knocking on 50 years ago since then. But we've done a lot to get the site ready. We've got 140 volunteers that are taking their own time up to come and volunteer, mostly from the company, but all over the company, but also some volunteers externally that are, you know, friends of the company that have come in to step in. A load of supporters from the operators, the vehicle owners, the stands, there's going to be food trucks. I mean, it's going to be great fun.
And as a railway person as well, we have to try and channel your inner geekiness now. Is there something you've been particularly excited to see or to get here? What are you looking, you know, is there something you want to go and stroke and remember?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple. Obviously, seeing locomotion number one, I mean, you having it on our site, 200 years old, and seeing how even things like the wheel profile hasn't altered that much, that's where it all comes from. I think the other thing, we were walking around earlier with the French ambassador to the UK, and she had a short tour before we did the opening ceremony. And I've been fairly calm about everything, and then I saw the Flying Scotsman under steam. My camera phone came out as well, just like everybody else's. So it's almost impossible not to be touched by all of these incredible exhibits. And a very silly one, there's a networker that's in the old Network Southeast colours, Chris Green, and seeing that brought me all my memories back commuting when I first started my career working in London and then working for Angel Trains at that point. So, yeah, great time. We're expecting quite a lot of visitors, a lot of railway family coming in over the weekend. And, yeah, some more famous than others, but none more important than others.
Just finally, have you been amazed at the level of the railway family interest? Yeah, I'm seeing MDs all over the place and chief operating officers and all sorts of people.
Walking around with their camera phones out, taking pictures on their own in a quiet moment, taking pictures of things because they're also enthusiasts. I mean, it's infectious, this industry. I'm doing exactly the same thing. So I'm loving it. I'm loving it.
Brilliant. Well, I hope the whole weekend goes fantastically. Yep. I bet you'll sleep well. Oh, no, you've got to turn it into a manufacturing
on Monday.
Site,
on Monday, I'm building Elizabeth Line trains again here. So I'm sort of slightly nervous that everything is still there on Monday. That's concern number one. But yeah, hopefully everyone will have had a great time. And then, yeah, on Monday, I'm going to be checking the production schedules as usual, making sure that we stay on track for delivering for our projects.
Carrying on the strong history of Parallel Lines nabbing managing directors when they're trying to leave the room, we've got the wonderful Andy Mellors here. How are you doing, Andy?
Well, I'm even better now. You've just described me as wonderful, Anna-Jane. But yeah, I'm doing really well. We've arrived here in Derby this afternoon with our Pride Pendolino, which is one of the exhibits over the Greatest Gathering weekend. Several of our team in Avanti West Coast have been, you know, quite heavily involved in the organisation of this event, working with our partners Alstom, who of course maintain our fleet. So it's been really great to bring a train here with our team and just recognise the contribution that, you know, the railways have made over the last 200 years to the economy, wider society, what the railways have done for connecting communities. And we're really proud to play a part in that this weekend. But of course, it's also about promoting the railway for future generations as well. You know, I'm a career railway person, and you know, I've had a really interesting and varied career, and I think if we can leave a legacy from these celebrations in 2025 that continues to encourage people to come and have careers in the rail industry, you know, we know that they can be hugely varied and rewarding, then I think that will be our legacy going forwards.
Just one last question, because we're also at this Greatest Gathering, so there's all these locomotives things, and you're a career railway man, but you're a bit of an enthusiast for railways as well. So
is Tony out in you as an enthusiast?
We've just been outed.
We've got to find out what's your favourite train here. What are you looking forward to going and just stroking and remembering?
Well, I, as some people will know, you know, my career in rail started as a engineering-sponsored student with British Rail, so I'm really looking forward to going around the site and reminiscing at some of the locomotives, some of the multiple units that I've been associated with over the years, you know, right back from when I started on the West Coast Main Line at Wembley and Willesden with the AC Electric Locos before the Pendolinos came along. The 507 that's here from Mersey Rail, where I worked for a number of years.
Is it like bumping into some old friends?
It's like bumping into some old friends, and I'm sure I will meet some old friends, you know, who are human here as well, and I have done already, actually, but, you know, I think that the thing is that you come here and you see some of these exhibits that you've been involved with over the years, and it just brings back a lot of happy memories. And I think, you know, I won't be the only one that leaves here this weekend with a smile on my face, reflecting on the great times that I've had in my railway career. And I hope that rubs off on the next generation.
Lovely. Enjoy it. Enjoy being here.
Thank you.
John Smith, who's the CEO of GB Rail Freight, and only a couple of weeks ago we were looking at your brand new locomotive. So you're sort of right at the other end of the Railway 200 story at the moment, aren't you?
Yeah, no, we are, Tony. And that's, I'm quite proud to be that. Although looking around here today, there's many a loco that I've had to work on over the years. So it's made me feel bloody old. Somewhat bizarrely, I've had quarter of that because I've had 48 years in it as of...
Wow.
Tomorrow, actually, I think it's the anniversary of when I started as a 16-year-old in York Carriage Works, which was the premier carriage works, far better than Derby Litchurch Lane. We built the best carriages and indeed started building units way before this factory ever got close to doing that. But yeah, no, I've been with it. It's quite scary when you think how much time. Seen a lot of things change, some for the better, some for the worse as time's gone on. It's always been a political football, and is even more so now with all the changes that are coming. But my role is, all I'm bothered about is GB Rail Freight, making sure that's a success and continuing its growth.
Well, I saw you at your event the other week. You were bending the ear of the Rail Minister in public, so he couldn't duck out of your question. So you've got some challenges for the government, really, as far as freight's concerned, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, you can get buried in the detail, but we need... they're clear, and Pete's clear, that we will stay private businesses, Freightliner ourselves, the other smaller operators. Within that, though, our rights of access to the network, what we pay for access to the network, how we're compensated or pay for poor performance is hugely important to us. It underpins the economics of what we do and, you know, drives ultimately the price that we'll charge customers for access to the network. And they've just got to be very careful they don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Clearly, with the infrastructure owner taking control of train operations and the planning of capacity and the timetable, human nature is such, and I think Tim Shovel has said that from Freightliner, that we run the risk of getting marginalised unless the law protects us or unless the access rules that spin out of the law support us.
Yes, I heard you at a conference calling for the passenger trains to be removed from one of your lines so you could get through. There's some passenger
trains.
Make way for freight,
yeah. Well, we have a saying, which I think Hugh Merriman coined, which I said the other day, that... I don't know what it is. 50% of the public use passenger trains, but everybody uses freight train.
Yeah.
If you're buying something via Amazon, it comes through your letterbox. Yeah. Almost certainly will have been on a freight train at some stage.
Can we talk a bit about technology then? Because being here at the Greatest Gathering, we've heard about how things have moved on in terms of modernisation, and you said you've seen a lot of things change in your 48 years. But we're not getting very far with electrifying places that should have wires up, are we really? And that's a bit of a hindrance to change for freight, amongst others, isn't it? Because there's these little bits all around that if you just managed to put some wires up, it would change the face of what you do, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, and I'd encourage that, but it's not happening.
It just isn't, is it?
No. And, you know, one of the worries as government gets closer to the railways, which, you know, they might regret that in the longer term, is that when he goes to the health service, to the military these days, to the police, to education, to the health service. So... we will always be marginalised for the capital that government wants to invest. And, you know, nothing's clearer than that on the electrification scene than not going to Derby, Sheffield and Nottingham. It's just bonkers not actually authorising that. So, but we knew that. The Class 99 is a loco that's got a big lump of diesel in it rather than a small lump of diesel in it. And that's all about shifting 2,000 tonnes on 10, 15 miles of railway at 50 miles an hour rather than waiting for the electrification, because it just won't happen. And we've got to decarbonise more. And, you know, ultimately the 66 can't last forever. So, and there's sort of windows. I mean, our difficulty is that assets last 40 years, whereas lorries...
A bit like you.
64. But the... thank you for that.
It's only good I'm 63, so I just checked.
Well, in that case, though. Because we have 40-year lives on these things. Our business does not have a future unless we get the next generation. So we've had to take the punt. We've had to take the risk. Hopefully they'll work. Stadler's been a fantastic manufacturer. No locomotive is manufactured in the UK anymore, despite what was being said earlier, which is a shame. But that's because most trains are units now that are passenger trains. So, we'll see. Hopefully we'll get some wires up at some stage.
I feel like we could talk for hours,
you've got to go around, but we've got to ask you the final question, because you're here at all these exhibits and you're a railway enthusiast as well. I've seen you on charters and dribbling over all sorts of rolling stock. So it's not just about the trains anymore, but what are you looking forward to seeing? What's going to bring back the most memories, or what's your favourite loco that you're going to see here?
Well, the most memories would be the Deltic. I mean, I served my time. Once I'd finished in the carriage works at York, I moved over to the Deltics in their latter days, maintaining them at the TMD at York. The Locos I like best, which I never actually worked on. I do like the Westerns as well. So both of them made a huge noise. They were bonkers. They had engines in them that should never have been used on rail, but they supported the industry for, you know, in the Deltic's case, 20 years, and they completely changed the East Coast mainline, which is where my loyalty lies and will always lie. You know, Midland Railway just had a small engine policy. They never quite got round to getting beasts on the front of their trains.
I'm loving this competitiveness. We've heard this from other people. It's great. It's like it's been baked in from the start of the railways, you know, like the Midlands versus the East Coast.
Is it your induction, they say? No, this, let's just tell you.
Well, the odd thing, I was thinking about it when you go back in history, is when I started, a lot of the senior managers were still around from when they'd nationalised it, and the loyalties towards their original national businesses. So the roots have really, even with the devolution now that Network Rail's introducing, the hardcore loyalty to a particular route, particularly core bit of railway, is still there today.
Yeah.
And for me, we go everywhere, so it's just about freight these days.
And you are the first person I've met who diplomatically went Deltic and Western in the same answer. And sat, the yes. fence you're sitting on must be really aching.
But I was there when the Western ran out of King's Cross to York, when in its 1976 November, I think it was. So.
I wasn't allowed out then. Anyway,
thank you. Lovely chat.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. James Dobson, you're Ops Delivery Manager for Avanti, but much more importantly, this whole Greatest Gathering is sort of your idea.
Yeah, it is, yeah. So I did the Crewel Change Open Day in 2019 and was just sort of so inspired by that. And then when the Railway 200 year was fast approaching, I just thought, you know, we absolutely have to do something to mark it. So alas, the Greatest Gathering was born.
And you've seen what the bookings are going to be like, 12,500 people a day, 40,000 at least over the weekend. How's that felt when you've seen the reaction and the numbers of people that are going to actually turn up?
Yeah, quite overwhelming, really, to be honest. A little bit nerve-wracking at times as well, I suppose, to make sure that we get it right. But yeah, was just blown away, really, by, you know, how quickly people got behind it and wanted to be here. And obviously that was evident with how quick the tickets sold. So yeah, no, it's just brilliant.
And you're but a youngster, really, compared with the oldies like us. So behind us there's a Deltic engine running, for those that remember it, East Coast in the 80s and so on. We've got the Pendolino, the Pride Pendolino behind us as well. It's telling a story for all generations here as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we wanted to create a really diverse event, so try and get as much representation through steam, diesel, electric as we possibly could, but also diversify it so that we're actually looking forward to the future and how really innovative the railway is, and encourage young people to come into rail and choose it as a career. So, yeah, hopefully we achieve that, but that was the aim with the Greatest Gathering.
And loads of families coming as well. That must be pleasing to know that the next generation is going to be coming and looking at the history and learning a bit more about railways and like you might decide to work for them.
Yeah, absolutely, and we've asked many of the operators to come with stalls to promote careers on the railway and talk about what opportunities are available really to all in each of their organisations. So yeah, hopefully if nothing else, this event raises a significant sum of money for charity but encourages people to join the industry, because it really is a fabulous industry and it would be nothing without its people.
Ben Goodwin, you're the event organiser. You spoke to us at Women in Rail weeks ago and you're all excited about it happening and now it's starting. How does it feel?
I've gone through so many emotions with this event. I think when I saw you, I was in the, yeah, we can do this phase, and then I've gone through the dark times. I mean, look, this is unprecedented. It is the largest gathering of rolling stock in the history of the world, and there's a small team of us that have organised this with the support of hundreds of people across Alstom, the rail industry, you know, and somehow we seem to have pulled it off. I'm a bit kind of, is this actually happening? I kind of thought, what would it look like? You know, here we are tonight and the public are coming tomorrow. It's just magical. And why is it magical? Because people have willed this to happen. Okay, Gus Dunster, James Dobson came to us and said, would Alstom be up for hosting this? And Catherine and I were like, yeah, why not? And it was a case of act now, beg for forgiveness later. This is an event for the entire rail industry, and not just the rail industry here in the UK. We've got Eurostar here, you know, this is international. And looking at the tickets that we've sold, we know that people are coming from as far as New Zealand, Chicago, you know, and it seems to be growing and growing and growing. And I just can't wait for people to see what we have in store. Sometimes with the rail industry, we get bogged down in the negativity, you know, things are late, trains are not on time and all that kind of stuff. But it's a great industry with great people. And that's what this event is about for me. It's about the people that are here coming together, whether it's people who've loved the railways all their life, or they're just curious, or they think that it could be something that they might want to make a career out of. It's just brilliant that we're able to bring all these people together for, sadly, only 3 days, because Monday morning, we have to start building Elizabeth Line here. You know, this is a train factory. This is not Disneyland. But it's great. I mean, we had a unique opportunity. We were between orders. It could have only happened this year. Do I believe in fate, planets aligning, all that kind of stuff? Right now, absolutely. Because it couldn't have been anywhere else. This is the only site that you can control. It's connected to the national network. And in that respect, I feel like Alstom had a duty to host this event. I think if we didn't do it, it would have been cruel. I really do.
So I've got Pete Broadley with me, who is Alstom's UK and Ireland Services Director, and this site's part of your empire. What are you looking forward to happening over the weekend?
I've never seen such a collection of trains and locomotives on the site that I've ever seen today. It's just a celebration, both of heritage of the UK railways over the last 200 years, but there's also an opportunity to see what the future of trains looks like as well. You can go on the test track and see an Elizabeth Line train going back and forth, and we've also got exhibitions which will show you the future of the railways as well. So it's great, such a great opportunity for us all to showcase the UK rail industry in general.
UK rail industry in general, I noticed a few products around here that weren't made by you as well. So you have opened up your site generously for this to reflect there's lots of people involved in making vehicles for railways.
Of course, I mean, obviously Alstom is at the centre of the UK rail industry, but this is a celebration for everybody. It's not just for us, it's for everyone who loves the railways and either use it as a punter every day, day in, day out, or is just an enthusiast who wants to come and have a look around the site.
And on the geeky bit, what's the one thing that's going to be your standout exhibit?
Oh, I love the baby Deltic. It looks amazing. The job they've done on that is just incredible.
Tony's just laughed at me because I'm walking across the vast expanse outside Litchurch Lane. That's terrible, isn't it?
The Derby site.
The Derby site. And I've just gone, ooh, look, a sprinter. He's just done a terrible mocking of me. But it is exciting, Tony. Yeah. The sprinter livery with the little runner and everything.
Yes. Yeah, I'd forgotten the logo, actually. Yeah, because there was a sprinter and the super sprinter as well, wasn't there?
And that's... Yeah. So we were just having a little chat about how these type of trains, there's a 142 just next to it, isn't there?
Yeah.
I think you spotted.
That was the great thing, the 142, this is interesting, just while we're looking at the generation of passenger trains, commuter trains that are just sort of being finally withdrawn or started to be withdrawn.
Finally.
But all the politicians that popped up and said, the much hated Pacer. And then you had to go and say, you do know they had an important role in saving the railways at the time when British Rail was bankrupt.
So, yeah, and have continued to do great service to the railway for far longer than they were ever expected to, really. I mean, when they built those trains, it's hardly likely that anybody thought they would still be, you know, churning out the mileage that they were.
Well, when they said, British Leyland are going to bolt the top of a bus onto a bit of a railway wagon and that'll save the railways and... Yeah.
That was a bit of a Wallace and Gromit idea to do that, wasn't it? Let's stick a bus on the tracks and see how that works out. You know, they've been workhorses for the railway for decades longer than we thought they would. So to see them here, you know, some people might be like, oh, that's not very exciting. You know, it's not the Flying Scotsman. It's not Locomotive One or whatever. But it's a massive part of our heritage, isn't it, of UK railways?
Yeah. And we were just looking at the sprinter here. So that's 1980s. So it's
just like me.
And still giving classic service.
Just like me.
To the railways. But the serious thing is that the big campaign in the 80s to get the sprinters into service and built. No, it's the other way around. The big campaign in the 80s to get the sprinters built and in service.
Build them first then.
Because people kept saying the trains they're replacing, they're nearly 40 years old. Now these sprinters that are still running in all parts of the UK, the southwest, the north particularly. Yeah. They are older than the trains they replaced. And at the time, people were panicking because we had to replace those old trains. Yeah. So history is repeating itself, as ever.
What's also happened in parallel to that, so that phenomenon you just described of, you know, people thought it was outrageous, they need replacing. Customer expectations have only gone up in that time as well. You know, what people expect from the interior of a train, what they expect from the exterior of a train, frankly. You know, that's only increased, hasn't it, over those decades that have passed. People really have high expectations of the cleanliness, of the quality of seats, you know, as we've spoken about before. Things like toilets. I know we would probably all agree that they're still not perfect, but people expect a certain standard, don't they? Whereas when those trains were replaced 40 years ago, people just didn't expect as much from them, did they?
No. And the interesting thing about these is, because we thought the sprinters were incredibly modern in the 1980s, look at these
modern trains that are coming in. If you're out there and you're able to ride on one, look around at how they're built, and you can see all the rivets, you can see the screws.
Yeah, and they're very mechanical looking, yeah, aren't they, compared to modern trains?
And you can see the repairs where they've bunged a screw in instead of a rivet and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then go and get on a train that was built in the last 10 years, and you can't see any of that. You can't see the screw holes and you can't see the rivets. Yeah. They suddenly discovered people rather like their trains to look a bit like your car. You don't expect to get in your car and see all the bolts that are holding it together in the passenger saloon bit.
Yeah.
And yet we were building trains only one generation ago where they were functionally built. So a lot has changed just in the way people expect their trains to look and
feel. That's not just a railway thing. I mean, so dad story incoming. So
do you know, I just had to tell people listening, people have come up to Anna Jane and said, how's your dad? You know, when she's done in the podcast and you've listened in the past, and she talks with fondness about her dad's railway career, there are people here that have worked with him or remember him. So
which is always lovely.
You know, some of them didn't ask you how you are.
No, I get that a lot. Yeah, how's your dad? And by the way, how are you? So when we were getting our first cars, you know, as youngsters in our family, my brother and I, my dad always said to us, you cannot have a Japanese car, you cannot have this car, you can't have that. Because for him as a mechanical engineer, as, you know, somebody who started working on these older trains, these more, you know, as you say, visible rivet type trains, to him the same had happened with cars, and he'd say, oh, I can't fix that for you, everything's hidden away under the bonnet, I need a car where I can lift the bonnet and I can see, you know, which bit I need to whack or which thing I need to unscrew or whatever. And so I think technology has generally gone like that, hasn't it? Everything's under the bonnet, everything's electric, everything's, you know, you plug the laptop in and you sort of reset it, diagnoses it and what have you. So this site is a really kind of lovely trip down memory lane, just in terms of seeing how much more physical and mechanical and everything trains used to be, whereas the ones that Alstom are designing and building now, it's the laptop era, isn't it? It's what they need from their engineers is very different.
Yeah, and this facility has still got all, because we're standing here, we're in the middle of bits that have been here since it was built as well. So there's this great big, they call it a traverser, so it's like a great big railway that moved the train sideways between different bits of the production line. And so we're looking at, it looks like a massive 8-rail super wide gauge railway, but it's a sideways railway, isn't it? That's how they did it in railway manufacture. You built a bit of a train in one building and then
you moved it along to the
bit where they put the motor on or the seats in or whatever. So.
And essentially, I suppose that's still how they do it, isn't it? But it's just the sort of automation factor is greater now, isn't it, than it used to be. And fascinating stuff. Right, let's move on.
And as we're just walking back along this facility, we were just discussing earlier, because John Smith from GB Rail Freight's been eulogising about his bi-mode locomotive, the saviour of the railways, possibly, or the future. And there's a Class 73. So it's a bi-mode loco from the early 1960s.
So yeah, so we haven't just invented it, have we?
We haven't invented it. They started building locos in the 60s that ran on diesel or electric because there were bits of the railway that weren't electrified. So this amazing discovery that we've had, and that, where was that? There's a tri-mode loco here somewhere that's got a battery in as well. So, you know, we're sort of reinventing stuff that we did invent years ago. It's just that it's cleverer and more powerful. And
I'm sure they say that, though, that there's hardly any inventions that are actually brand new. They're all based on, you know, something. And I think ultimately they end up being based on nature, don't they? And it's just somebody's, you know, created something that, like, a hummingbird can do or something. That's a random quote.
That's a little bit random. We just walked into this hall, and there's a video being made, because railway videos are now fascinating as well. I watch a lot of them, seriously, to learn stuff. One of the originals is Jeff. Tell us a bit more about yourself first, very quickly.
Hey, Tony, thanks. I'm having a bit of nostalgia, because we're in this, I don't know which actually shed we're in, but there's a lot of blue and grey British Rail livery here, and there's a Class 313 over there, which I've probably ridden on, and there's the 455 down there, which I've definitely ridden on, and there's the networker in the Network South East livery, which I've definitely ridden on. Basically, I'm feeling quite old now. I'm thinking, well, all these trains are like, what, 30, 40 years old? It's making me feel old.
I think some of them are older. For 50, the 507, wasn't it? But you discovered that people like to watch videos about railways. So, it was almost an accident when it started, but it's become a thing. And the more you do, more people want to watch. And your history, your stuff about London Underground and all the different lines and the quirks, has it surprised you that people want to know so much?
You were very kind, thank you. I think a lot of people, people definitely like their tube trains more than anything else. So, you know, as a London person, that was always an interest to me. I think what's nice is that as I've made videos, other people have made videos, people have very kindly said, you know, because of your videos, I've got into trains or worked on in the industry. I met a bus driver once and said, I came a bus driver because I was fascinated by your transport videos, Jeff. So I moved to London and got a job in transport.
Oh, wow. What a lovely story.
That's a true story. Yeah, he's up at Golders Green.
So, love that for him.
And there's now many people online and YouTube and whatnot that all make their own transport videos, which is a lovely thing.
I know, when Tony said you were here earlier, I couldn't quite place who he meant, and I said, oh, is it that young lad? You know that young lad who's always...
I wish, yeah.
No, he said, yeah, yeah. He is quite young.
Yeah, I'm younger than us.
I'm in my 20s, yeah.
The quick cross plug, how do people find your videos?
Just Jeff with a G, not a J. Jeff, if you type, I met someone the other day, they went, how do I find you? I went, just Google Jeff Trains.
Oh, excellent.
And Google just knows who I am now, which is hilarious. But yeah, it's great to see you. This is going to be an awesome 3 days, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for doing your little bit on our podcast, on our teeny tiny podcast. We appreciate it.
So we've just come into this building here, which has got mainly multiple units in it from, I would say, the last generation probably.
Yeah, kind of the latter days of... There's quite a bit of sort of British Rail type livery in here and a little bit of the... Was that the start of the privatised railway or the back end of BR?
They were the back end of BR. Yeah. They were ordered by Chris Green.
Yeah, Network Southeastern.
So there's a turbo here. There's a 507 from
Merseyrail 507 for the last from Liverpool. Yeah.
The 313 over there, they were introduced when British Rail took over the line to Moorgate from London Underground so they could run on the third rail or the overhead wires. So this is when you age, because I remember travelling from Birmingham down to ride on those 313s, and they were the most modern thing you could imagine.
Yeah, because that would have been, everywhere was still slam door and all that jazz, yeah?
Yeah. And
apologies, there are things going on around us, including, interestingly, where they've got the 507, they're actually offering pit tours.
Yeah.
I said that really specifically because I thought the accent might naff that up. So you can have a little crawl around where, you know, where people undertake maintenance of trains. I assume they're letting you have a moment in the life of a fitter or a multi-skilled rolling stock technician, as I understand they're called nowadays.
Should we go and ask if we
Let's
can
go and have a look.
Have
a look if yeah, see if we can.
So just tell us what we're able to do.
So I'm with the 507-001 train. You're able to go underneath it and sit in the driving cab, go inside. We've got the train all lit up for you to see. We've also, down the far side, we've got a pseudo destination blind set up, so you can program in all the Merseyrail destinations that our train went to, and it will play the announcements and scroll the destination blinds.
Oh my goodness, so I live on the Merseyrail network. This is quite exciting to get to have a play with this.
Are you Northern Line or Wirral Line?
I'm Northern Line.
So you can go put any of the Northern Line routes in. If you want, you can put the message for Southport Flower Show, Southport Air Show. You can put all other things that you remember seeing.
Oh, this is awesome.
So I came with you guys on the farewell trips around the Merseyrail network, which was quite an emotional time because it was saying goodbye to a generation of trains. How long had they worked on Merseyrail?
It was 40 lots of years. I think it was 46 by the time they'd finished. This is the unit the Queen went on. We reckon this has been to the moon and back 4 times. It's not travelled that much.
Oh, wow. I love that stat.
We like those facts because we were talking the other week on another podcast. People have been asking, you know, how far do trains go in their lives? So that is quite a good one.
That's amazing. There's a man with some hard hats, Tony. We need to put some hard hats on.
That's great. Oh, where's it going? Just what's going to happen after to this train that you lot have preserved? Didn't you get it for £1 or something?
We bought it for £1. It was generously donated for £1 from Angel Trains. We ran a successful crowdfunder, which paid for our transport away from the network. People that paid in our crowdfunder, you've got sponsored seats on board with their names on. And we're staying here for a little while. We've got plans to fit batteries to it in the future. We've got all sorts of plans that we hope to go through with it.
So this is just the start of the next chapter of the 507's journey then?
Very much so. We've got so many things that we want to be able to do with this unit. It's just not going to sit and rot. It's going to be out and doing stuff.
I love that it's not just going out to retirement. It's going to go on to a new life.
And the thing to remember is it's not the easy bit is the getting hold of the thing, because you got it for £1. The challenging bit is looking after it and keeping it running.
Exactly. And that's why now it's lit up, it's full of air, it's ticking away to itself just like it would have done when it was on the network.
Lush.
Thank you. Let's go and explore. Thank you.
So I don't know how much this is going to carry with the medium of sound rather than vision, but we're actually descending the steps down into the pit here. We're going to have a little a walk around underneath one of these lovely retired 507 units with our guide, who's going to show us how to not hit our heads on the
unit. Underneath one of the bogies, so each vehicle's got two of these. This is what drives it. This is the traction motor.
Yep.
So these are what drive the wheels and make it go.
Just tell us what, because this is going to be in the background all the way through, what the ticky noise is that people are hearing.
So the train's currently got air in it. So that's from the reservoir tank, and that's what's called a Spirax valve. So that lets all the moisture and that out of the air tank, stops water from getting in it. So that ticks constantly once it's got air in it.
Just to explain, you don't really get this on modern traction because they have air dryers fitted to them. If you get moisture in the tank, it can cause all sorts of technical issues. But this is a sort of an archaic way of how they kept moisture out of the air tanks on the train. This is what supplies the air to the doors, to the brakes, and also in the case of the 507, the traction equipment as well.
But we've now explained then, for those of you that for 40-odd years in Liverpool or in other parts of the country were wondering what the hell the noise was.
That's what it was.
40-odd years, you finally got your answer.
As we get closer to it, so I'll have to show you what it was.
Yeah.
So that's it now. So that's just getting moisture out of the tank.
Okay.
So you can see bits of water in that now and again which come
out. So just to describe it, it's kind of just, it looks like a tap that you would have like under your sink, with some bolts on, and there's just an open end which is gradually dripping and almost, it's hard to see amount of water, it's so small really. Yeah.
The noise is explained.
Yeah,
thank you. It was worth coming.
46-year-old question.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was worth coming all this way to this, the whole celebration, just to learn out what the ticky noise is. Right, what are we?
Stop at this bit. So these are sandpipes.
Oh yeah.
So trains, in you probably heard of trains being delayed due to leaves on the track and stuff like that. So trains are fitted with sanders. They supply sand onto the rail that helps traction for the wheels when braking and when accelerating as well. So it comes down through these sand pipes via air pressure, which brings the sand through, and that gives it better traction on the rail.
And again, just to describe the visual here, because obviously people can't see this, it's pretty primitive, isn't it? It's literally a pipe that's pointed at the wheel, and it's gonna discharge some, literally spray some sand onto it.
Yeah. So
simple but effective.
Yeah, and it works. And every modern trains have this. Pretty much every train has one of these fitted to it.
If it works, don't try and reinvent it. Like
the pair of us, we're both drivers, and we drive modern traction Pendolinos and 807s, 805s, and it's the same sort of principle as a sander pipe that drops some sand in front of the wheels onto the rail and helps with braking in lower teasing conditions.
Yep.
But so one of the important things is, before you take a train out, is to check you've got enough
check
sand.
Check you've got sand in your box.
Yeah.
We learned that on a previous episode, didn't we?
Stacey
Thundercliffe mentioned that was very important.
She did.
Yeah. This thing here, this is the centre casting, this bolt. That's what's holding this bogey onto the bogey, is what the wheels sit in and the body sits on. That's attached to the chassis of the train, and that's what's holding that on. So if you were to literally pick this up, it would dangle, or should dangle, from that pin there.
And this is just literally a massive bolt, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, there's no other way of describing that. It's probably about half the size of my face, the size of that bolt.
So for those of you that don't know how big Anna Jane's face is, it's about twice the size of the bolt that we're looking at. That is amazing, because, again, the energy that's being generated by the motors to move the train is being transmitted to the rest of the train through tiny little spigots, basically.
Correct, yeah. Because the weight of the train and that's not doing anything for now. Yeah.
The area of the train we're in now is where a lot of it happens. If you look to either side, you'll see these are the shoes for the third rail. So a lot of arcing and sparking would be happening in this area when they're sitting in icy conditions as well. So this is quite an important part of the 507.
People forget about the third rail in Merseyside. You know, they think of third rail as being like a southern thing, you know, and everyone's all a bit scared of it. Like, the third rail. It's like, we've got it up north as well. Just, you know.
Yeah. Indeed.
These are the air pipes, these two pipes. Yeah, so this pipe is what transmits the air from one coach to the next coach to the next coach. So,
and that's for the braking, mainly?
For braking and everything for the air tanks on the train, which does the doors, horn, washers, pretty much everything is air what works. So it all goes through that pipe there.
I'll be honest, I didn't know air was such an important component. You know, you think of mechanical older trains and you think of things like oil. You think of, obviously, metal. There's a lot of metal going on, but just plain old air and pressure.
Yeah, that's it.
And no computers.
No computers.
Not like a modern sort of, you know, as I say, this is very much air and amps is what the saying is in the industry now, to get it to move. Air and amps, and you can get the train, the wheels to turn.
And the interesting thing, we're looking at these air pipes. Obviously, they are critical, because if they break, the brakes come on. And so when people have, there's been an incident, maybe you've hit an animal on the line or something, and the brake pipe gets damaged. And when passengers are sitting there saying, well, it's only a bit of air, what's the problem, or whatever, these are very key, because you can't release the brakes unless they're sealed.
And also, this is what we call fail safe within the industry. Everything on trains is designed fail safe. So if something goes wrong, it's in the safest way, it's going to affect things. If that breaks, the train's going to stop, it won't move anymore. And everything on the train is designed that way. If something breaks,
and everything on the railway generally, isn't it? Because I'm from the other side. I'm from the signalling side as an operator, and the signals are like that as well. If it breaks, everything goes red. Yeah. We're not going anywhere until we've fixed it, and that's what makes rail travel as safe as it is, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Appreciate you guys are, you know, not train designers, but I'm just thinking logically. Why did we not hide all these bits that are vulnerable to getting, you know, knocked and what have you?
I suppose because the way this is designed, it's so easy for uncoupling it and stuff. And this design pipe isn't just used on units which stay coupled together. They use it on coaching stock, which uncouples. So, like, when you see a locomotive with coaches on, these use the same pipes, and it's easy for them to get down, uncouple it, and can be done within minutes. Yeah. If it's hidden away, it makes that a lot harder to do. So it's just the easeability, really.
It was a loaded question, because I think it comes back to what we were saying on the previous episode about downtime is really expensive. You don't want the train on the depot for any longer than you have to. So you want everything you need to maintain to actually be really accessible, don't you? And we're seeing that walking under this train, because if you had to take a cover off and find that and faff about with it, well, it's going to take you so much longer to maintain the train, isn't it?
Modern trains are light. I mean, the Pendolinos that we drive have got what's called skirts on the side, same as the 800s that we drive, and it's access, and you have to lift the bolt of this. It's all free, it's all open, primarily because it's lower speed. The maximum speed of this is 75 miles an hour. Pendolino would obviously...
You need a bit more protection on if you're going over 100, yeah.
For example, a Pendolino takes a day to uncouple a coach because of everything so hidden, and to be able to unbolt it in that. This, you could get it done within a couple of hours.
And that's the difference, yeah.
So we're back under the end coach now, so back to... This is a driven coach, so we've got the traction motors which drive. So this is the main reservoir tank, which holds all the air. So this has got a compressor on this coach, which is just behind your head. And that is what, when the train would have power going through it. At the moment we've got a shore supply which is providing air into it. But when the train's on power on a third rail, the compressor here would run and provide air into this tank here, which then provides all the other tanks for the auxiliary systems for the train. So this is the main thing, what creates the air in this coach here. And it's all done from that one compressor there when it's running.
Thank you very much.
Okay, yeah.
Good luck with your preservation and all
that. Thank you, it's good to see it here.
We've hardly seen anything, and time's flying.
But that's because we've seen things we didn't expect to see. I mean, I did not expect to have a fully guided tour of the underframe of a 507, Tony. That was amazing.
And we finally found out what that sort of strange ticking noise is.
Tick noise.
That wouldn't be yours. Right. It's quite a beautiful evening, funny enough, for this nostalgia, because it's beautifully sunny. It's a clear blue sky virtually in Derby.
In Barbados, the sun has come out.
That's been quite an episode anyway, hasn't it?
It really has, and not what I expected. We've spoken to a few people, which is always lovely. We've seen some things, like I say, that I wasn't necessarily expecting to see or to get excited about. And if you haven't managed to make it, hopefully we've given you a little bit of an insight to what's been going on, and I'm sure there'll be loads of videos and clips and what have you doing the rounds afterwards, and have a look and see what's been going on.
Yeah, on to probably quite a normal podcast after this adventure next. We'll have to have a day out somewhere else, won't we, next?
We'd do a normal one, I think.
This is just a little extra bit. It's Saturday afternoon and I've popped back for the day and just spent it here at Derby with 12,500 other people, just enjoying the day. And it's fantastic, the number of people that are here, the families that are here are fantastic. It's great to see the next generation interested. Hopefully some of them might be interested in working for the railways and doing their part in the next 200 years. And I just have to congratulate all the organisers and all the people who brought exhibits and everything, because it's really been quite an amazing event, and it has been the greatest gathering.